Hey, what's going on, you filthy animals? Welcome back to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Joshua Lukemuller. This week's episode, I had Blythe Burns on. He's someone that I got connected through LinkedIn on. I put out through my professional network asking guests, professional guests who had a wide range of experience in the investment world to see if they would come on. And this guy reached out to me. He's a little bit older than me, a couple of years older, and he's a hustler in his own right. And he's working in a field that, to be honest with you, everyone and their mother wants to be in, right? It's called private equity. It deals with the valuation of private businesses. In his case, it's smaller capped companies, very small, actually, in a lot of ways, micro cap companies. But it's a really interesting niche because so many people, when they're studying at the university level, they want to get into private equity, and it's a really hard competitive process. He kind of breaks down the path and journey he had to go through to get to where he is. And I'm going to tell you right now, he doesn't have a traditional path, which is even better. It's why I loved having him on. He's a wealth of knowledge, and he's actually got a wonderful opportunity as well for you guys listening in. And he'll talk about it more on the podcast. But guys, really stay tuned for the entire episode. And I'm going to drop all of his information down in the podcast notes. Please, if you are interested in pursuing a career in this field, I am not the guy to talk to. I don't have experience in this field. But he is. And Blythe, if you make the connection, if you put yourself out there, I'm sure he'll want to help you out. So, you know, that is my pitch to you guys. If this is someone you want to learn from, especially if you're in the Texas area, please, please consider reaching out to him. But without further ado, I hope you guys enjoy this episode. For all you guys tuning in to the podcast this week, I have Blythe Burns here. Blythe, welcome to the podcast. You want to give us a little bit of introduction of who you are and what you're about, man?
Yeah. Thank you, Joshua. Blythe Burns. I'm a partner at the Burns Firm Capital. We're a small cap private equity firm. We actively find businesses that are underperforming, acquire them and turn them around and hold them for the long term.
Okay. And how did you get into the PE space, right? Most people that are going through college, that is one of the first things they want to get into. It's the sexy, revered career. How did you get into that career field?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Joshua. It's kind of a long story, and it's not your typical traditional, you know, you go into FP&A, move into IB, and then then move over to the buy side. It's a little bit different. And things are very different on the small cap side than the large cap investment management.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can kind of describe how I got into it. Which would typically be different than your average other kind of person would get into it.
But different is good. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, it's different is good. You know, people realize there's other paths in than just the traditional, like you said, IB route like that.
Yeah. And I think that any one of my friends would not describe me as a traditional type person. So I think it kind of fit in, but how I got into the space is, I'll kind of go back, while I was going through college.
Yep.
I needed a way to fund my college. I did not get my college funded by my parents, and I needed a way to be able to make some money so I could go to college.
Yep.
I tried to start some businesses right out of high school. I decided, you know, college is a waste of time. I'm going to go start a business and I'm going to, you know, become a millionaire in a couple of years. that did not go well. It went negatively. So I fell flat on my face on a number of ventures. Spun my wheels a lot. Didn't realize, you know what? I will go to college.
What did you learn in that experience, though, of you failing? Did you take anything away from that helped propel you into this next level for you?
Countless lessons. Number one, making sure that when something's not working, at some point that sunk cost fallacy does really play a role. As much as you hate to admit it,
sure,
you just got to let it go and move on. And that I think was the biggest lesson. But I got countless lessons that just have expanded over the years. But yeah, getting back to my pre-college trajectory, I ended up getting a job that was able to pay for some school and allow me a little bit of money to start investing. And I was kind of looking around like, how do I grow my money? Because eventually I need to go to a 4-year college. I'm at a community college right now. How do I do that? And I leveraged a small student loan and I started buying and selling TVs on Craigslist. I've always had this interest in high value TVs. At that time, LED and LCD TVs were just a thing. So the flat screen TV is a big deal. Yeah. So I figured, there were some entrance and exit opportunities in a cyclical manner on Craigslist in Dallas and DFW. So I would literally buy, the whole market would just plummet at a certain time of the year. And then it would just bubble up at another time of the year.
Really?
I'd buy these $3,000 TVs for pennies on the dollar, brand new TVs that, you know, cost like $5K at Best Buy. I would buy them for $500, maybe $1,500. And then I would turn around and sell them later at, you know, $3,000 and $4,000. So
nice
I kept
return.
Doing that. That's a fantastic return. And, you know, it's a real grind. I mean, all you're doing is texting a bunch of random numbers, negotiating, trying to figure out, you know, how do I get this product for cheap? And, you know, I did other things other than TVs, but TVs were the main thing.
And hoping you don't get killed on Craigslist too, right?
Hey, I met some drug dealers, and I always got the best deal from drug dealers because
yes.
they got the TVs for free from
That's
whatever
awesome.
They had going on.
Oh,
so yeah.
Sure.
So then I kind of got into the TV market kind of dried up. We were coming out of the Great Recession, and so people started, I guess, affording the things that they were buying. And so those kind of deals dried up. I got into cars. I made some decent returns on that, but you know, the repair costs and the taxes really, really eat you up. So I ended up sitting around with a bunch of money and I'm thinking, okay, I got another year before I got to go to college. I have about half as much as I need. I need to figure out a way to bump up my returns or really just deploy my capital some way. And my dad had bought a ranch in North Texas.
Okay.
And now any kind of agricultural operation, the main cost driver is the cost of the land.
Yeah.
So I figured, okay, I mean, there's a lot of land, so a lot of unused land.
Yep.
And I figured, okay, if I can get this land for free, I can certainly do something maybe with cattle. And I by the way, I know literally nothing about cattle. my dad's kind of dabbled in cattle and his parents had, one of the largest ranches, in New Mexico, that he had grown up with. And so I had some little bit of an in, as you could say, in cattle. And so I reached out to this cattle buyer. I got introduced to this cattle buyer and talked to him. And turns out that Oklahoma was going into the biggest drought that the experts said had ever happened. And so all these Oklahoma ranchers are all just trying to sell their cows.
Yeah.
And so we got into this massive arbitrage opportunity where cattle is for the same exact cow. It is going for 50 cents on the dollar in Oklahoma than in Texas.
Really?
So
50 cents on the dollar?
50 cents on the dollar. So I'm like, this is impossible. This does not make sense. This cannot be sustainable. So I can buy a cow for 50 cents and then I can go to in Oklahoma and I can go to Dallas and sell it for a dollar. That's
almost
impossible. That's
almost
stupid.
A risk-free position. Almost.
Almost a risk-free. So the only thing you had to work out was don't get your cattle stolen by your transporter. And,
right.
And what are the transportation costs?
Right. So, oh, my God, dude. That's insane.
So that's what I did. I bought and sold in Oklahoma, and I actually held to increase my returns. I held some what are called long-bred heifers. So they're female cows that have been impregnated for an amount of months, so they're pregnant.
Right.
And I held them to where the pair of a female cow and a calf is actually, you know, is a greater value than just an impregnated cow.
Yeah.
So I held them on the land, and then I ended up selling them, and I was able to fund my entire undergraduate career on that. on that the money that I had before paired with the money I made arbitraging the cattle markets. So it was a really great opportunity, but seriously, mostly luck. I just lucked into a great opportunity and just, you know, I just rolled with it.
But you were smart enough to recognize what it was. So, you know, I mean, how old were you when you did this?
I think I was 23, 22, 21, something like that.
Okay. So you were okay. So what were you doing up until then? Were you, just like, a JC, a junior college or things like that?
Yeah, I was going slow. I would take like three classes. Okay. I was trying to run the investment firm, working full time. And I just looked up one day and I was like, this is unsustainable. I'm going to be, you know, 30 years old in college. I gotta get on it.
Yeah.
I just wasted too much time trying to start my own company, wasted too much time piddling around without just any idea where I was going until, you know, everything just kind of started falling in place. So then I went to college. I went to Texas Tech University, Ross College of Business, comes up. I got an undergrad in finance, focused on business valuation, and I graduated. I got a job at a valuation shop in Houston. Took one look at the job and said, you know what, this is not for me. So then I decided, okay, I need to either go find a job or I can go back to grad school. I know I eventually want to go back to grad school. Sure. So I said, okay, I'm just going to go to grad school. So, turns out it was 6 weeks after the deadline. They had already accepted or rejected the MS candidates. So I just reached out to someone in admissions for the MS program at Texas Tech and a couple other schools, just trying to brown nose my way in.
Sure, absolutely.
And you know, SMU, they said, you know, you're too late. I'm like, oh, that's fair.
Who wants to go to SMU anyways, right?
Hey, I will say I wanted to go to a different school than I had gone in undergrad.
Yeah,
I wanted to leverage some alumni groups, but, you know, all you can do is just roll with the punches.
Yep.
So at that point, I tried to get in UTD, too late, and I was still working on some leads there, trying to get in front of some senior leadership there to try to squeeze my way in. And it just so happened that at Texas Tech, I just had more traction. I'm talking to this admissions counselor, and they're like, yeah, no. And I'm like, I understand that, you know, I respect that, but these rules are set up to safeguard your practices. You know, I know that you don't have any control over that rule. Who does? Could you just like introduce me to your manager? And they're like, well, you know, that wouldn't work. And I'm like, well, hey, no big deal. Just give it a shot.
Yes.
So, you know, brown nose my way up to the manager, that manager, then refers me to the next manager. I finally get up to the dean of the finance program.
Oh, you animal. Okay.
I think he's thinking, what is this kid, you know, doing
right
on the phone with me? Like,
yeah.
Like clearly people have told him no. So he tells me no. And, I figured he was going to tell me no. And I had a three, I forget what it was, but it was a really, really great, sales pitch line.
Okay.
And it centered around, I've done a lot of great things. I am exactly what you want in the MS program. I'll make your program look better.
Oh,
you know,
kind of a
aggressive, possibly douchey way to say it, but I was under a lot of pressure. Yeah. I'm all in at this point. Like I have not been looking for a job. Like I had been trying to get into college.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And
you're in.
And so he tells me, he's like, oh, well, why don't you, I'm going to send you an application. Why don't you have it on my desk or email? I forget what his exact words were. Why don't you send that to me by Monday and we'll see what happens. So long story short, I get into the program. Now they do make me take the GMAT, which is absolutely horrendous. I had to study for 1 week. I had 1 week to prepare.
Yeah.
I did so terribly that I didn't even look at my scores. But they ended up letting me in. I'm not really sure why or how, but I got in. I got into some great programs. I got into this Smith program, which is a student managed investment fund. Where we're able to evaluate securities in a pretty, pretty realistic fashion. We did have a Bloomberg terminal.
Okay.
Or it was me and a team and we all had our own Bloomberg terminal. And great, great system. I missed that.
Yeah.
I think you even had a or have got certified in Bloomberg concepts, right?
Yeah, well, I had a Bloomberg terminal for about 3.5 years for my job when I was an MBS trader. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I miss
so
it. It's awesome.
Right. Yeah. We definitely all miss it. Yeah. So I actually started really getting into equities trading, and I created this this equities screener model, and based off of the EQS screening tool in Bloomberg.
Okay.
And it actually worked out well. I made 30% annual returns fairly consistently. So, but eventually, I lost access to the Bloomberg terminal, which means my model wouldn't run on any other kind of data set. So,
right.
Just kind of let that go by the wayside. So at this point, I'm kind of looking at what career fields I'm looking for. About the time between undergrad and graduate school, all my life I've kind of looked at my friends' parents and kind of figured out the friends' parents that are really, really doing well in life, what did they do? And my friends' parents that are not doing well, what did they do?
Mm.
And I found that pretty consistently across the board, my friends' parents that were consistently doing well in life, they had all gone into complicated industries. So, oppositely, the people who didn't do well went into not complicated areas.
Sure.
And so what I wanted to do is I was like, okay, I'm going to learn from that. I want to go into the most complicated area that I can possibly get into, which for me is operating company private equity.
Yep.
And besides that, I do genuinely love the complexity, the creativity required, and the technical skills required to evaluate, acquire, and manage an operating company. And so that's what I made my mind up. I was going to do that, and I didn't want anything else. That is all I wanted. So I graduate from graduate school, and I hit the job market. I'm looking for jobs. I got a couple FBA offers.
Yeah.
I would literally tell people, and this is wrong, anybody that I ever, try to help give advice, I would never do this. I would just immediately say, I don't want that. I appreciate it. That's very kind of you, but that's not what I'm looking for. And I'm laser focused. I'm laser focused on operating company private equity.
Yeah.
I don't want anything else. So the reality of it is it's the first job. You got to get a job.
Just, you got to get a
simply
job.
Get a job. Yeah. So,
yeah,
that's what happened. And I shot myself in the foot. I went into a too difficult career, with not enough experience, too soon. I was too green for the stuff that I was trying to get.
Yeah.
I did some, I think you could agree with me, right?
Yeah, PE is a really hard one to break into. I know a few people. I think you're right. Traditionally, where I've seen people break in is they do that normal FP&A, right? Like, I know a lot of oil PE guys who ended up working at Halliburton on their finance corporate development desk, and then they use that to get into PE. That's how I've traditionally seen people get in.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So, yeah, I had networked well with MDs at PE groups in Dallas and Fort Worth, and I just didn't find the right opportunity. I did get some offers, but nothing in the real tangible analysis that I wanted. And so this entire time, I had been working for my dad doing an M&A, the transaction analysis. He has an M&A practice in Dallas based off of his tax advisory firm. And I had gotten a little bit of experience. I enjoyed the work, but it just wasn't as fulfilling as I had hoped. And so I went to him and I said, hey, what if we start our own PE group? We've got the experience. We've got the technical skills.
Right.
You've got the money and I got the energy.
Why love don't we, it. Yes.
Yeah. Why don't we put these together and try to do some transactions? And I said, some of the transactions that we're working on right now, we understand the business. We like it, right? And one of these is actually terribly run. No one wants to buy it because it's not a good company. It's not an investment. It's a project.
Right.
I said, let's do this. Let's create some marketing material. Let's see if we can drum up some deals, and let's see if anything comes through. I mean, at the very least, you know, I'm a big proponent of at least trying and failing than to never have tried at all. So long story short, that was in late 2017, early 2018. Then we were able to close on a company, a very underperforming company, which is our portfolio company as of right now. We were able to close on it, acquired it. It was an extremely big job. I was definitely very green at the time, trying to figure out what was necessary. But I had a couple ideas of what I knew a couple things that were definitely wrong, need to be fixed.
Yeah.
And as I got in, I found other things that were wrong, need to be fixed. And it took about a year and a half to restructure the company, learn everything I needed to. You know, I'm trying to learn soft skills. I'm trying to learn technical skills. I'm trying to learn, you know, a corporate, large corporate environment on the entrepreneurial side. Right. And all of this at the same time. I mean, I was working 60, 80 hours a week.
Yep.
You know, pretty consistently. It was really, really hard. But I am a big proponent of strength through adversity. You're never growing if you're comfortable. I'm really glad that I did that.
What are some of the metrics you look for? Like, you know, you said this company was failing. How do you evaluate these companies? What are you looking for? You don't have to give us your secret sauce. I'm just kind of curious.
Oh, that's okay.
What are some of the things you're
looking for? So, yeah, that's really easy. So there's definitely different levels of evaluation in a company. But at your most broad, at your 10-second evaluation, you look at cash flow.
Yep.
Is cash flow positive or negative?
Okay.
Pretty bad if it's consistently negative.
You're
right. in 5 years, this company never had a positive EBITDA or even cash flow.
Whoa, was it a family-run business? Or, I mean, what's the story there?
Yeah, it was a family-run business.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, the owner had inherited it from the father. And,
yep,
you know,
makes sense.
That person certainly tried, and it was just the wrong things done at the wrong time.
Yep.
So it had flourished. It had been founded in the early 50s.
Oh, wow.
And it was in a great industry. But if you just leave the wrong people in leadership, you know, that'll drive any ship into the sea.
Isn't that crazy? So, like, to think about, like, and that even goes in the public markets. Like, leadership is everything.
It is scary how much control that is, and that's something that you just don't know. When, like, from my experience, I was in school. You know,
right.
I think, okay, if you got a good product.
Right.
Got a decent sized company, right? It's pretty hard to fail.
No, it's easy.
False. It's so false. Yeah. So, you know, I went in, I had to figure out, it's very niche manufacturing. So I had to figure out who did what and if they were good at their job. And it was really, really difficult. I had to fire a lot of people.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Alone, which is, I think out of everything I have faced in my career, the worst parts are firing people. There's one guy and I fired, and it was really bad. And I don't think I've ever in my at least corporate career ever gotten close to shedding a tear. And that really got me close. Yeah, so I mean, hey, fun times are hiring people. You had to do some turnover, had to restructure culture. I mean, it's a real battle. And you have the headwind of being younger than every single person at the firm, and that certainly it can work for you. It can also work against you. You just have to wield it correctly. It was a hard time, but kind of going back to what you had asked about, you know, what I look for in a company. Acquiring a company that's already running well, that's fantastic, right? But you pay a pretty high valuation for that. what I have found is that, you know, we as a firm and my dad, we're good at figuring out what's wrong with the company and how to fix it. And so that's kind of our sweet spot, is taking underperforming companies and turning them around. And that's kind of where we've focused. We're about to close on another underperforming company, and got some others in the works. But you know, you look at employee count, turnover, you look at cash flow, EBITDA, market fundamentals. I mean, there is no cookie cutter way of evaluating a company. Every single company is different.
Right.
Yeah, I think the best way to describe a skillful acquirer of companies in any connotation is we're all just faster learners than everyone else. I think that's really the single skill that someone on the buy side has, is we just learn faster than everyone else. And you're making a really big bet on a turnaround. Do you know in your, you know, 6 weeks or 2 weeks or 6 months on that job with that particular company, do you know the market better than the person who's been running it for the last 30 years? And that's an extremely strong bet to make. And if you get it wrong, you can lose your shirt.
Right. What are your exit strategies on these deals? Like, how long do you typically hold these portfolio companies, or what are your plans? Are they forever holdings, so to speak?
Yeah. So every company we acquire for the infinite future, right? So Obviously we don't know the future. We don't know what's going to happen. But yeah, we have a buy and hold strategy. Our goal is to amass a very large portfolio and spanning across, you know, many different industries. And so yeah, we don't plan to liquidate these companies. We've got a really good strategy that seems to work very well. And it all centers around solid fundamentals, no financial engineering, and good quality people that work at these companies. As long as you've got that and a decent product, you're good to go. You're golden.
What are your deal sizes typically? Are you looking for companies $1-2 million range, or what are your thoughts there?
Yeah. So we're typically looking at companies at an EBITDA below $2 million.
Okay.
Above $2 million is something that maybe in the future we'll tackle. But right now our sweet spot is between $500,000 and $1.5 million in EBITDA.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like that. You know, I know we talked about this offline. What are your plans of expanding there? Are you looking for people? I'm just curious, you know, what your thoughts are there as you expand this puppy.
Yeah. So, right now we've got a pretty leverageable team. So, what we're doing is growing organically through increased technology, increased offerings, increased services. And then we're also growing acquisition-wise, where we're acquiring really, really tiny, what I call micro companies, and then bringing them inside, physically inside our manufacturing plant in South Texas.
Okay.
So I've got a really close magnifying glass in South Texas, looking for, you know, companies that are doing $500,000 in gross revenue. And packaging them up and bringing them on in and integrating them into our portfolio company called Gemco. And that's the strategy so far. Of course, we still are looking for other sponsored platforms, companies by themselves that are big enough to have a leverageable management team. So every time we acquire a company, you know, we'll typically bring their management team and their technical people in whatever industry they're in and bring them on inside. So it's very easy to do that with the large facility we have. We have a significant larger facility than we need, and so there's a lot of room for growth, and that's what we're doing. We're just filling up all the capacity that we have.
Yeah. What about interns? What are you looking there? How does someone, you know, younger get into this world?
Yeah, that That's a million-dollar question, right?
Yes.
If you go to undergrad at any school in a finance program, you know, I'd say 90% of them, if you ask them, do you want to get in private equity? Their answer is yes. So everybody, everybody and their brother.
I agree.
They want to get into, you know, investment banking, private equity, mm-hmm. the flashy, sexy stuff.
Yeah, man.
But never underestimate the value of a good firm that needs an FP&A, an analyst or associate that has a wide variety of experience they can offer. That is invaluable. That gets a good, strong foundation to your career, I think. That would be my advice.
Explain what FP&A is. Some people might not know planning, what that is.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Financial planning and analysis. It's your analyst of analyst roles. It's generally a more generalized field or job than a strictly analyst role, but those titles are used almost interchangeably. And that, if you get with the right firm, you got the right team, right size, you can do a lot of great things. The larger the company you get, typically the less responsibility you get. And so it's harder to distinguish yourself, but you can still get a great foundation in your career. But I think the best piece of advice that I could give somebody is, if they want to get into operating company private equity, take as many accounting classes as you can possibly take. And I was told that, and I was like, ah, not true. Yeah, you don't know. I was wrong. That was flat wrong.
I wish I took more.
You what?
I wish I took more accounting classes.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, part of what I did during the restructure was overhaul our entire ERP system, which is trying to drink out of a fire hose as a non-accountant. I still took a bunch of accounting classes, but you never take as many accounting classes as you could or should. I would recommend that someone take more accounting classes. Dual majors are a great, great skill set. And then try to get an internship at a direct investment firm, maybe family office, maybe a professional acquisition company. Yeah. At some level, just do what you can. And I'm not talking about going on LinkedIn. You're not going to find those type of opportunities on LinkedIn or Monster or whatever site you use. I'll tell you the best story I ever had for a guy who was looking for some guidance. In high school, this has got to be the smartest and most outgoing high school student I've ever met. He just cold called the office. He cold called my office. And it just so happens, director of operations, Allison, picks up the phone and she says, answers the phone. And he says, I'm looking for some guidance. I need someone to help me in my goal of becoming a finance graduate. And so she ends up taking his information down, sending it to me. I get on a phone call with this guy. What a sharp kid. I mean, good night. I wish I was like he was in high school.
Cold calling a firm like that in high school is pretty crazy, man.
I've never heard of that, but yeah, he did the right thing and he got into the right person. I mean, I'm always looking for somebody to help that maybe was in my position, growing up and in college, there for a few years. Like I said, I didn't really have a direction. I wasn't sure where to go. And then I wanted to get into private equity and that was very difficult. I'm always looking to give back to somebody, give them the opportunity that I never had. And so I was able to mentor this guy through, I think it was his senior year. And, he just got accepted to a really prominent school. I mean, fantastic guy. He's going to go do great things. And then that was one way I found to give back. And at one point I actually, I've got all these projects that I'm working on. And of course I don't have a large staff at least on the direct investment or investment management side, right, to leverage. And so I reached out to one of my old professors at Texas Tech, and I said, hey, give me one of your top performing students, and I've got, if they want to get in private equity, I've got their dream opportunity. And so I did end up getting a getting introduced to a young guy that's just graduated, incredibly smart guy, going to do great things through his life. I was able to give him projects and exposure that he would have never gotten at any other investment management firm.
100%. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I would literally send him data sets, and I'm like, this is what I need, so figure it out. And you know, if he had questions, I could kind of tell him, here's how you do it, or here's what you could do. But I left it really open to him. And these were not job or projects that I couldn't do myself. So, you know, if he royally screwed it up, I just redo it myself. But I gave him that exposure to be able to talk about in interviews down the road. And that, I think, is invaluable. And he did. He got an incredible job offer. I'd say he's probably in the 80th or 90th percentile. And I like to think that I played a role in that. While that being said, though, it was all him and his tenacity. So yeah, and of course he's graduated, moved on. So I am kind of on the hunt for someone else that I can kind of help, you know, give an opportunity to. And so yeah, that's kind of my advice on how to break into PE. You know, don't go for the sexy stuff. Go for the stuff that'll kind of build your career. Get yourself a mentor, somebody who's on the same career path as you want to be, and yeah, get an internship wherever you can and cold call. Don't underestimate the value of a cold call versus an application.
100%.
The last time I made an offering for a low level job, I put out the job. I had one of my staff put out a job opening, and I got almost 200 applications.
Sure.
So as they're coming in, this person is printing off the resume and the application. They're putting it on my desk. I walk in and I see like five, and I'm like, okay, cool. I'll look at these in about 30 minutes. I come back in an hour, and I've got a stack that's bigger than my fist. And I'm like, impossible. I'm not even going to look at these. And I'm thinking to myself, not one single person has reached out to me. That's what I'm looking for. I'm waiting for someone who says, I need this job so bad, and I want it so bad, that I'm going to call you, and I'm not going to let you go until you give me an interview. And that's the kind of tenacity that I'm looking for, especially in a competitive opportunity, just like a private equity analyst. I see those opportunities on LinkedIn every once in a while, and I look at it, 1,500 people applied in the last 2 hours. That's outrageous.
Yeah, they're not. How do you think they're going to trim that list of 1,500 down? They're just going to trim the people that didn't reach out, didn't take the time, effort to give them a call.
Exactly. And so for the opportunity that I described, I never even looked at any of those guys' resumes. And I ended up, one guy called up my office and said, I want that job. I'm the guy for you. Let me come tell you why. And I was so impressed. I'm like, hey, can you be here in 30 minutes? Come here whenever you want, and you got an interview, right? And I'm sitting here, I got my own stuff going on. I will make time to interview you because you called me. You told me you wanted it worse than anyone else. Out of 200 people, one person called me. Now, he wasn't the right person for the role, but you know what? He got an interview, and he got an interview whenever he wanted. And then I ended up hiring a guy that was introduced. Someone at the company vouched for him. One of the best hires I've ever had, and it worked out extremely well. Fantastic guy. It all comes down to, if you have an in, utilize it, right? That's that's insurmountable. If you don't have an in, just cold call them up, say, I want to know who your hiring manager is. Or if you got someone's name you can drop, say, hey, I want to talk to XYZ. Odds are you're not going to be told no.
Right.
Because no one does it, because it takes such gumption to do that. So yeah, those are the things that I would advise to somebody who wants to get into operating company private equity or any really coveted job.
Right. I like how you said you place emphasis on like the family office type roles, because I feel like most people, they think they have to go for the sexy big banks on Wall Street. And although that sometimes can work, I've seen it work better if you just work at family offices, and that way you really get that direct experience like you talked about. Because in these interviews, I would imagine they test you, right? Like, are they making you put to the work models? Are you really like in these interviews? Yeah.
Yeah, they're really, really technically inclined positions. Oh yeah, they're making you do a three statement model at the very least. So yeah, and at times too. So you know you got to be on your A game. But you know, on the family office style or family office setting, it typically it's pretty hard.
It is
to get into that right out of school. You typically see people that are there pretty seasoned in their respective field.
Right.
So I think if I was starting out, you know, obviously I wouldn't say no to that opportunity, right? It's a fantastic opportunity, but that's a larger barrier to overcome, I think, based on my experience.
Sure. Well, I like that. Is there any other messages you want to put out to kids listening that are still unsure of where they want to go in the world of investing or finance? Any last advice?
Besides the advice that I just gave, I think be aggressive. People always kind of advise or advise younger people, you know, be aggressive but not too aggressive. I would say no. Be incredibly aggressive. Obviously, you know, there's a limit to that, but be aggressive. Don't sit back and wait for an opportunity. Don't sit back and hope that someone's going to help you out, or hope that, your uncle that has all those connections is going to just spoon feed them to you. Be aggressive. Everybody loves helping somebody. So if you call somebody up and say, I need help. No one's ever, I mean, you have to be a real dick to not want to help someone who says, I need help.
Right. That's yeah.
That's anybody. And you'll find them. You'll find, you know, someone who says, you know, I'm not interested in talking to you and hanging up on you. You're going to find those people. You just got to, you know, have a tough skin, but be aggressive and find those people that are not, you know, angry and mean, and they're going to hang up on you. Find those people that will say, I'd love to help you. I'll set aside what I have going on just to help you. And honestly, that's most people.
That is a lot of people. I 100% agree.
Yeah.
Because they get something out of it too, right? Because, you know, if you spend the time to develop somebody, you don't know, you know, what that could, you know, turn into down the road, you know, if it's another employee, if it's another business relationship, you name it. So it's like in your best interest as well to help people out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I had a business school professor. He said, you know, whatever I do for profit. He said, either financial, emotional, physical, I do something because I do for profit, which I thought was kind of funny because it kind of leads you down a different path until he explains. But yeah, that's exactly right. And to kind of take what you said, you know, further, is even if none of that materializes, it is still exceptionally emotionally profitable to help somebody. Take somebody who is downtrodden, who is limping along, just trying to make his dreams come true, and help him. And that is, and that will help. That will give him a taste of what you should do when you're in a position to do so. And then he will help the next person. And I think, you know, I don't want to get too soft here, but you know, every little piece that we can do to restore some kind of humanity to this world, I think is worth taking. And so,
Sure. Yeah,
I think giving back in any capacity, you know, maybe they come around and help you, maybe they don't, maybe they're able to help other people. Let's just help people wherever possible.
Yeah, I like that. Well, wonderfully said, Blythe. Well, again, I appreciate you coming on. I want to have you on again sometime. I'm going to put this out and make sure, you know, for you guys listening in the Texas area, you know, if this sounds like something up your alley, are they okay with reaching out to you? Is that, what do you think?
Reach out to me. Be aggressive.
Okay. You heard it here, folks. If you liked his story and you want to do something very similar, reach out to this guy. Don't wait for him to reach out to you because he's likely not going to. And grab the bull by the horns, man.
Absolutely. Couldn't have said it better myself.
Well, perfect, Blythe. Well, I appreciate you coming on, and we'll talk soon, and I hope you have a great evening. Take it easy there in Texas, man.
Hey, you too, Joshua. Have a good one.
Yeah, you too. See you, man.
Bye-bye.
As always, you filthy animals, thanks for tuning in. Stay hungry, keep grinding, and I'll catch you on the next one. Peace!